advantage of an opportunity that soon may be lost. Barry Schwein has more.
Only 10 months ago, Baker was keeping his distance from Middle East missions, advising Arabs and Israelis to give him a call if they were interested in peace. But now he is hip-deep in Middle East diplomacy, planning a third trip over a span of a little more than 6 weeks. On last week's trip, Baker found Arabs and Israelis agreed in principle to hold peace talks, and that was a diplomatic breakthrough. But lots of tough issues remain unresolved. They include who speaks for the Palestinians, whether the Soviets will be a real participant or only an offstage presence, and what kind of conference to hold. However, there's enough agreement on the main point to hold negotiations to send Baker back out on the road again. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwein at the State Department.
The Soviet Republic of Georgia has created a new presidency with sweeping powers that its leader says will strengthen its international standing. The Parliament of the Southern Republic has elected Zviad Gamzakhurdia to serve as president until a May 26th election. The move pushes Georgia ahead of other independence-minded republics and even further away from Moscow. Last Tuesday, Georgia declared its independence from the Soviet Union. In Albania today, the opposition Democratic Party boycotted the opening session of the communist-ruled National Assembly. Members said they would not attend until authorities have identified and arrested those responsible for killing four anti-government protesters on April 2nd. On Wall Street today, stocks closed higher. The Dow rose 12 points to 2933.17. Advances led declines in active trading of 162 million shares. This is NPR. The European Community has decided to lift its remaining economic sanctions against South Africa. From London, Michael Goldfarb reports.
The announcement was made at a meeting of EC foreign ministers in Luxembourg by German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher. The community's foreign ministers will lift sanctions on the purchase of gold coins and the importing of iron and steel. They were the last remaining items in a package of sanctions in effect since 1986. Last December, European Community heads of state agreed to lift the ban on new investments in South Africa, but had agreed to continue with other sanctions until the South African government had sent legislation to end apartheid to the country's parliament. The South African government did that in March. The EC decision was made despite the fact that on Friday, the African National Congress told the community that it was too soon for sanctions to be lifted. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Goldfarb in London.
President Bush is warning that a coast-to-coast rail strike could severely disrupt the economy, and he's calling for railways and unions to make a last-ditch effort to resolve the dispute before Tuesday's midnight deadline. Most of the nation's 235,000 freightline workers said they'll walk off the jobs at 12:01 a.m. Wednesday if no breakthrough in the three-year-old dispute is reached. Wages and health benefits are at the heart of the disagreement. Notre Dame basketball coach Digger Phelps has announced his retirement today after 20 years of running the Fighting Irish program. Phelps came under fire while his club was on the way to a disappointing 12-20 mark last season. In his two-decade stint at South Bend, Phelps built a 393 and 197 record, including 14 NCAA tournament appearances. The Boston Men's Marathon has been won by Kenya's Ibrahim Hussein for the second time in 3 years. The winner in the women's category was Wanda Panfil of Poland, with a time of 2 hours, 24 minutes, and 18 seconds, the second fastest time in women's Boston Marathon history. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've been watching with horror the pictures of starving and dying Kurdish refugees. What's been most heartbreaking for many Americans has been the faces of the children. When my guest Pham Thanh was a child, he was nearly killed in the Vietnam War, but he's lived to adulthood and to tell his story. That story is the subject of a documentary called Thanh's War, which airs this Friday night on most PBS stations. During the Vietnam War, Pham Thanh and his family lived in a small village near Da Nang in what was then South Vietnam. They were regularly visited by the Viet Cong and by American soldiers looking for Viet Cong. One morning when he was 12, Tan's village was under siege by American soldiers. Tan, his mother, and grandmother were emerging from a bomb shelter when a grenade exploded. Tan's mother and grandmother were killed, and Tan's esophagus was severed. An American tank crew took Tan to a hospital, and there a delegation from an American humanitarian agency realized the youngster was dying and sent him to the U.S. for medical treatment. Tan was treated in San Francisco and adopted by an American family. Over time, he recovered from his wounds, but his voice was left permanently hoarse. He's now 32. He's an American citizen, and he works as a technician in a lab that manufactures artificial hearts. Journalist and filmmaker Elizabeth Farnsworth met Tan in the Bay Area and documented one of his visits home. She also joins us. The film they made shows Tan's complex feelings about his homeland and about his adopted country, which both saved his life and killed his family. Tan says he still has nightmares and flashbacks about what happened to him during the war.
Well, I was just telling Elizabeth this morning, the other night I was over at her house talking about one of the, you know, stories, and I came home that night having a dream, bad dream about the war, yeah. It will always be with me.
What was the dream?
The dream was I was telling her about a particular story where I was sitting under a tree, you know, staying out of the sun in the midst of the day, and the three helicopters approached and started shooting up the place, and I had to exit from that shade and nearly got killed.
Were helicopters the most frightening thing about the war?
I would think so, because they can come and go as they please, and it was such speed that sometimes you can't get away from it.
Did you have close calls with helicopters when you were young?
Too many, I would say. One particular one that they caught me coming home from the paddies, out in the field, and I was standing right in the middle of the front door before I could enter the house. This helicopter barked me down and hovers over me for, you know, good many minutes there while an NVA soldier's, you know, AK-47 was training at it. And I was standing there and the M-16 was aiming at me with the rotor blades literally blowing the house apart. And finally they tossed a smoke grenade down and trying to get me to run. So, and, of course, the first thing I learned was... when they do that, try not to run, because it just gives them more reason to shoot at you. So I was standing there wetting my pants and my knees were shaking, and I thought I was goner. You know, I would be shot dead right there in front of my house. So it, I guess stories like that, people would never understand how the difficulties of living through a nightmare like that.
You know, in watching Tan's War, the documentary about you that will be on public television this week, I was thinking about how you must have incredible drive to accomplish what you have and to have just emotionally and physically recovered from what you've been through. I don't know what my question is exactly, but it seems to me you must really be driven in a way to have... been able to comprehend a new culture the way you have and to be able to just come out of things the way you have?
Yeah. If, you know, I myself do not know what those, force of driving, driven me to this day. But I think, especially when one lost everything, as I have, one have to go on, continue, and especially to... be able to have the opportunity to thank all those who saved my life. That's one force of driven me to live.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Pham Tan, who is the subject of a new documentary called Tan's War that you could see on most public television stations this Friday night. And he's Vietnamese. Most of his family was killed during the war. He was taken to the United States, was brought up by a foster family, and has returned several times since to Vietnam. Now, you've returned to Vietnam, to the village that you grew up in, around, I guess, about five times since 1980. How has your village been changed by the war?
Well, yeah, first I'd like to add to what you said. Most of my families, I think immediate families, all of it was killed in the war except me. So how has the village been changed by the war? I think, it was 5 years after the war officially ended when I got back, and people was barely scratched together a living, and back then everything was collectivized, and so people was working very, very hard, not only for the state but for themselves, as trying to get their lives back together. But today all that is different because of private farmings and private businesses are back again. And so the people are really, in a way, doing very well compared to my time there.
Now, you recently married a woman from the village you grew up in, and it was an arranged marriage. You asked, I think, aunts of yours to find someone. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it was. I shouldn't say it was all arranged. I had a little bit of Americans in me. I did, suggest that is there anyone that I can look up to? But, you know, I wasn't about to, you know, have to make all the decisions. But in a way, they did, because they live there, they know, and I sort of relies on their feelings and outlook.
I guess, you know, since you had become partly Americanized, I'm wondering why you wanted to have an arranged marriage. You know, it seems so antiquated to most Americans, and it's something that I think a lot of people who live in America wouldn't feel comfortable going back to. But obviously you did. Obviously it was something you wanted.
Yes, it was very much something I wanted from the time that the tank crew put me on top of that tank to the day that I married that young woman. I had dreams and hopes of going back and to start a new life, to pick up where, you know, people took away from me a little over 20 years ago. You know, if it wasn't for the war, I'm sure, you know, I would be a little rice farmer out there in a little village of Binfu and be perfectly happy. But because of the war, it destroyed literally everything that I had, including my own life was abrupted and uprooted, and so I want to make sure it replanted and replanted firmly back to where it belonged. And I don't think people may have different feelings about it. People think that America is great. So do I. I never put America down for being great. But at the same time, got to look at my life and do what I have to do. And that is to appreciate the biculture I have and, the language I learned and the what America gave me. You know, today I'm hoping to be able to carry out a mission of teaching Vietnamese children playing baseball, which is very, very much American. And that was part of my life growing up in this country. And just recently, I just returned from Vietnam, spending 5 months there, doing exactly that.
Now, right now, your wife continues to live in Vietnam while you continue to live in the United States. What are the reasons that you're living apart from each other?
Well, I think, someone in the government probably can answer that better than I can, because I don't understand it myself. The only thing I understand is that our government carried out a sanctions and an embargo against the Vietnamese government and the people and the country of Vietnam. And so, you know, I just came back from a 5 month visit there, and my feeling is that it is not the Vietnamese. What is going on with my government here in the state that not allowing me to, freely able to, go back and do businesses in Vietnam. So it make it very difficult for me to deal directly between the governments to get my wife here for a visit. That is what I'm looking forward to, is to be able to bring my wife here so I can take her to Disneyland, show her the, her husband's side of the world. And, I don't think anything is wrong with that.
Terry?
Yes?
The immigration situation is sort of complicated. Tan's wife, Thiet, could come here as an immigrant. As you know, there's a whole program under which many immigrants do come here. But she's not sure she wants to immigrate. She's not an opponent of the government. She doesn't know that she wants to leave the country. It's easier to emigrate from Vietnam for her than it would be for her to come for a visit. That's what Tan's trying to do. To get a tourist visa is almost impossible for a Vietnamese young woman living in a peasant town, as Thiet does. And Tan can't work in Vietnam unless he gives up his American citizenship, which he doesn't want to do. It's against the law to do business in Vietnam for Americans. You can't do business in Vietnam. So that's why they have to live separately until they resolve this. It may be she will decide to emigrate, or the embargo may end, which I think it will, in the next year, and Tan will be able to do business there.
My guest is documentary filmmaker Elizabeth Farnsworth and Pham Tan, who is the subject of her new documentary, Tan's War. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Pham Tan, who is a Vietnamese-American. He was injured, nearly died during the war in Vietnam, was flown to the United States and after his family was killed in Vietnam. And he was brought up by a foster family in the States. And now he has a wife who lives in Vietnam. His story is the subject of a movie that will be shown this Friday night on most public television stations. With us also is the woman who directed the movie, who made the movie. Her name is Elizabeth Farnsworth. Let me ask you why you wanted to make a movie about Tan, how you met him.
Well, I was working on a story for KQED-TV in San Francisco, a story on the Vietnamese refugee community in San Jose, just south of here. And I needed an interpreter. So I called a friend who knew Tan and said, take Tan. He works weekdays, but he could probably come with you on a Sunday. And I was shooting on a Sunday. So I called Tan, and he said, sure, I'll come along. We went to San Jose and did the work. And on the way home, I asked him how and why he had come to this country and when. And Tan told me his story, which seemed to me an extraordinary story. He told me how he saw the first American soldier in 1963 or 4, and he saw the first villager killed by an American. He told me about being harassed by American troops, and these troops, of course, were my friends, my family. My brother had been in Vietnam. My boyfriend had been in Vietnam. My college friends had gone off to Vietnam. And it seemed to me extraordinary from so many points of view, because Tan is a villager from a Vietnamese very small village near Da Nang, and these are the villages where the war was fought. We fought over those villages, but who had ever heard the story of the war from that point of view? And the other reason it seemed extraordinary to me was that he lacked bitterness, and he seemed to have, as the Vietnam vet in the documentary says, the American Vietnam vet, Tan, you've gone through some wall that I just haven't gone through yet. And I thought that experience, the way he had reconciled his pain, would be useful for anybody, a Vietnam vet or just anybody who'd faced a terrible loss.
You know, one of the things I thought about watching your movie is, the kids who were kids in Vietnam during the war are adults now. And they've lived through that, and they have stories to tell that we haven't heard yet. They have a perspective we don't know about.
That's right. There are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of children that were wounded in Vietnam or killed. And I don't know any place that their story has been told that an English speaker can get to. And Tan was one of those children, and the only reason that we can know Tan's story is that he, through this strange paradox, after these soldiers killed his family, they brought him here. And this wonderful foster family took him in, so that we have, he can speak to us, and we can listen to this story and hear that whole side of the war.
Did you have to convince Tan to make the movie with you? Did you have to talk him into it?
No. Tan has always wanted to tell his story, because I think Tan has understood that he speaks for so many people, and I think he was very aware of it. And even though this was a painful process in some ways, because we had to dredge up so many memories, I think Tan wanted to tell his story, and still does.
You returned with Tan to his village in Vietnam to shoot some sequences there for your documentary. Now, since the United States has not normalized relations with Vietnam, did you have difficulties in getting into the country and getting permission to film there?
No, we did not have any difficulties. It was frustrating because we dealt with the Vietnamese mission to the United Nations. They were not frustrating. They did everything they could. But like any bureaucracy, they sent our request back to Vietnam. We had to get special journalist visas. And like a lot of bureaucracies, they put it off until the last minute. So we didn't know that we got these visas and that we had permission to shoot until about a week before we left, which is kind of hard for a film crew. It takes a lot of organizing. But the U.S. government doesn't try to prevent this kind of an effort.
Elizabeth, when you were in Vietnam, was there anything that you would have liked to shoot that seemed maybe too private to you to actually take film of?
Well, we were careful. You can see there's a scene near Tan's family's grave. We were careful what we shot, and we didn't ask Tan questions at that time that were very... He was in a lot of pain at that moment. We tried to be very sensitive about it. But in the village as a whole, people seemed to want to tell us their stories. I had talked to Tan about it before we left, and he had said, you know, some people just want to bury, even in Vietnam, they may not want to talk to you because this is a village that was entirely destroyed by American forces. It was attacked several times. It was burned and it was napalmed until there was nothing left. And by 1972, everybody had gone.
May I ask that it was also defoliated, so it even made it worse.
It was completely destroyed, and now you walk the paths and there are little mounds along the paths where people were buried quickly during the war and their bodies haven't been moved. There are bomb craters. You look into a, you know, off into a sort of a, it looks like a paddy maybe with a hole in it, but it's a, or with a pond in it, but it's a crater. And there are wounded, war wounded. You walk the path, somebody will come towards you with no arm or no leg or a maimed hand. But I did find that people wanted to tell their stories, and we were treated with such kindness and such courtesy and curiosity, too. People wanted us to come back. They wanted to know, had any of us fought in the war, had the men and the crew fought in the war. And only in two cases were we accosted and treated angrily. In one case, we were shooting children that were running towards us on this path, and in the middle of the children, all of a sudden, we heard a loud, angry voice, and a woman came towards us shaking her hand at us. And my interpreter, who the Vietnamese government had assigned, said, she's saying, come and see what your people did to me. Look what your people did to me. And she was shaking a maimed hand. She was missing most of the fingers on her hand. You see this in the documentary. And she said, I was in the fields. I was working. The planes came, and they bombed me and my child. My child's head was cut off. My mother's stomach was torn open. And this happened to my hand. And now we can't work because my other son was wounded in the war and is too weak to work, and only he and I survived. And she was clearly angry, hurt, but not bitter in some way. By the end of the conversation, she was saying, look, this wasn't anybody's fault. This was a terrible mistake that occurred between two countries. Come back, and we'll make things right again. And then in another case, we were walking along the path, and John Canoop was shooting in another. He was quite a ways behind us shooting a water buffalo. And it was just before Tet, the Lunar New Year. And a man who'd been drinking too much, this was the only time this happened, came down from his house and started yelling at Tan, and he was swearing. And he said, Tan, why did you bring these people here? They killed your family. They killed my family. And why did you bring these people here? And I don't know exactly what you said, Tan, because we never translated it.
Well, yeah, there were some pretty nasty words that came out of him. But, of course, you know, we got to remember, it, as you recall, he was, you know, drunk. So we can't, you know, hold against him for what he said. And I told him that these Americans had nothing to do with what happened in the past. They have, you know, anything that happened to us, they have no ideas of, you know, other than what I have told them so far. So, you know, after that, we went on.
So let me ask you, are you both friends now? The movie's finished.
Well,
we're very close friends. We've become really good friends through this process. I feel like I've learned a huge amount from Tan, and I hope we'll always be friends. I want to go back to Vietnam and watch him with his baseball teams.
Yeah, and, you know, again, I'd like to add that, yeah, from the day that I helped Elizabeth with her work, that very day to this, to right now, I feel that we've been wonderful friends, and not only that, you know, what we have done was walking through a path that was almost impossible, and we've done it. And I feel really appreciated what she's done and helping, you know, to tell the stories to to Americans and to the world what happened in Vietnam, what happened to me. And it can only take these kind of work to bring those stories out. One other thing, of course, now is that Elizabeth's husband is a little league coach, and you know, he's expressed interest of helping me to teach Vietnamese children about, you know, baseball. So those are the happy moments for me right now. And may I say so on the air, if anyone's out there listening to this show, the thing I'm looking for now is not dollars, not cash. I just want to receive some baseball gloves. I need lots of them. And if anyone's interested, they can send it to me, care of KQED.
And you want to send the gloves to Vietnam?
And I want to send those gloves to Vietnam because I got, you know, millions of kids over there who want to learn how to play baseball.
Well, Pham Thanh, Elizabeth Farnsworth, let me thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Pham Thanh and filmmaker Elizabeth Farnsworth. The documentary Thanh's War airs this Friday night on most PBS stations. By the way, Thanh and his wife Thiet expect their first baby this summer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ethnomusicologist Stephen Feld says, when we cut down a rainforest, we don't just lose precious natural resources and a complex ecosystem, we often lose a whole culture. Coming up, Feld plays us music he recorded in the rainforest of Papua New Guinea by a people whose way of life is threatened. Also, TV critic David Bianculli tells us what he thinks of the 90s. Not the decade, the weekly public TV series about the decade. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Thousands of Iraqi Kurdish refugees were given a new home today. Turkish officials moved them out of primitive camps high in the Turkish mountains and into a new refugee center further inland. NPR's Deborah Wong has more on the story.
Several thousand Kurds were loaded onto trucks and buses and taken to the new center near the Turkish city of Silopi. According to Turkish officials, the center will house 20,000 refugees. It has electricity and water supplies. The center will be a vast improvement over the refugees' present conditions. For the past few weeks, most have been camped high in the mountains with only primitive shelter and limited food and water. Turkish officials had at first refused to allow the refugees off the mountains and into Turkish territory. However, today a Turkish military official said the conditions had gotten too bad in the mountains to allow the refugees to stay. It's not clear how many of the refugees will be moved to the new site, although relief officials warn that all of the refugees must be moved before an epidemic of disease breaks out in the camps. I'm Deborah Wong reporting.
In Washington, U.S. officials say that they have received reports from international relief groups that up to 1,000 Iraqi refugees are dying every day on the Turkish border. According to a State Department spokesman, supplies and medical assistance are being moved in as fast as possible, but many of the refugees are growing weaker, and as a result, the death rate will likely go up. The State Department says that international organizations estimate that 1 million refugees have entered Iran from Iraq, with hundreds of thousands more heading that way. A couple of hours from now, Soviet leader Gorbachev lands in Tokyo for the first visit ever to Japan by a Soviet president. Justin Burke has more from Moscow.
A territorial dispute involving four islands in the Kuril archipelago will figure heavily during Mr. Gorbachev's four-day visit. The Japanese claim the islands were illegally occupied at the end of World War II and are refusing to extend the kind of financial aid Moscow is looking for until they are returned. Despite the need for assistance, Gorbachev is unlikely to promise anything more than to open negotiations on the matter. Gorbachev on Monday was in the city of Khabarovsk in the Soviet Far East. There he urged local government officials to work with him as he tries to solve the nation's economic crisis. He also laid a wreath at a memorial to Japanese POWs who died on Soviet soil. For National Public Radio, I'm Justin Burke in Moscow.
White House officials say that the U.S. and the Soviet Union have to work out differences on a conventional arms treaty before there can be another summit meeting. However, spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that the U.S. no longer insists that a nuclear arms treaty still needs to be ready to initial before a meeting can be held. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 12 points to close at 2,933. This is NPR News. In London, the European Community has agreed to lift its last remaining sanctions against South Africa, thus ending bans on importing iron, steel, and gold coins. Officials from Italy and Germany said the move was decided during a meeting of foreign ministers of the 12-nation trading bloc. But the EC will continue to observe the UN ban on sporting events with South Africa, as well as UN embargoes on arms and crude oil from that country. In Washington, Secretary of Transportation Samuel Skinner met with rail union leaders today in an effort to avoid a strike scheduled for midnight Tuesday. Kay McFadden has more.
One-third of all the nation's goods move by railroad, and if union representatives and company officials fail to reach agreement, not only the railroads will be hurt. The administration estimates that up to 500,000 layoffs could result in industries dependent on train deliveries. President Bush, facing an already battered economy, earlier today pushed for a quick settlement.
Because of the potential economy-wide disruption, it would be prudent that all efforts and actions be taken to avoid the strike. My administration is willing to work with the parties to help in any way possible.
One party Bush has yet to call on is Congress, which has the authority to order strikers back to work. But such action is considered unlikely in light of the strong affinity between unions and key Democrats. From Washington, I'm Kay McFadden.
Nearly 500 people escaped in lifeboats from a Greek ferry boat after fire broke out in the ship's engine room. According to Greek officials, there have been no reports of injuries on the car and passenger ferry, which was on its way to Rhodes when the blaze occurred. Greek Army helicopters dropped flares to light up the nighttime skies and help with the evacuation. Eight ships went to the rescue of the blazing ferry in one of that area's most heavily traveled sea lanes. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Environmentalists have made us aware of how essential the disappearing rainforest is. Stephen Feld has found something in the rainforest that environmentalists don't usually mention, music. Since the mid-70s, Feld has been studying the music of the Kalali people in the rainforest of Papua New Guinea. He's made four trips there over the past 15 years. Feld is an ethnomusicologist at the University of Texas at Austin, and his recordings of Kalali song have been available to fellow academics, but now the rest of us can hear this music. Some of his recent recordings have been released on compact disc in a world music series produced by Mickey Hart, a drummer with the Grateful Dead. Feld's new record, Voices of the Rainforest, shows a day in the life of the Kalali people. Before we hear the songs of the people, let's hear Feld's recording of the sounds of the rainforest itself.
Thank you.
You say that the Kalalee people think of themselves as voices in the forest. What do they mean by that?
It means that they're not distinct from the world of sound that they live in. It means that they sing with the birds, they sing with the insects, they sing with the water, and when they sing along with them, they try and sing like them. They're inspired by them, but they're also part of the same musical soundscape. They're not distinct from them, either spiritually or musically.
They even have a word, don't they, for this kind of multi-tracking of sounds that goes on naturally in the rainforest.
Right. This is the term they use to refer to all music, whether it's the music of nature or the nature of their own music, and it's Dulugugunalan, which means lift up over sounding. I know that's an awkward translation, but there's no better one. It just means that every sound is dense and layered and overlapping and interlocking and alternating, that no sounds are discrete, that you hear everything in this very deeply blended way.
Well, let me play another example of what you're describing here as singing with the natural sounds. And this is a woman singing by a creek.
Right.
Talk about the kind of singing here and what's important about it.
Well, what's important about water is you can't walk for more than a few minutes in the rainforest without crossing some kind of stream. And the Bosavi people say that songs are like water. Songs flow like waterfalls. They say when they compose songs, it's like getting a waterfall in their head. So creek sides are a favorite place for composing, and they're also a favorite place for singing and thinking about songs. And this is a kind of relaxing, but they're also singing with the water. It's sort of like choosing a nice waterfall is like choosing a good Steinway. It's an activity meant to kind of enhance the aesthetic experience of the activity of composing and singing. And that's what we have here at this creek. This woman has just composed this song, and she's trying it out, with a nice gurgling stream.
Let's hear some of it. We're listening to part of Steve Fell's recording called Voices of the Rainforest, recorded among the Kalalee people in Papua New Guinea. Now, since you started going there in the 1970s, things have begun to change. I think one of the big changes in that area is that oil was discovered under the rainforest. What effect is that having on the lives of the people you've been working with?
Well, potentially this massive discovery of major oil reserves in an area about 25 miles away from the Bosavi region is going to have extraordinary consequences. It's a very major oil reserve. 150 miles of pipeline will have to be built down to the Papuan Gulf to exploit that oil. That will mean roads into the rainforest, into these remote rainforest regions. That could potentially mean logging. And we know that mining and logging are the two things that have the most dramatically intense impact on the destruction of rainforests and the destruction of the cultures that live in the rainforest. But I should say that these people have been in continuous contact with Western ideas, with government, with missionaries. Since the late 1960s, there's been a certain amount of change that's ongoing there. This is not entirely new. In these small-scale societies, we basically find that people want to change. They are very interested in cash. They're very interested in all of the material items of the outside world. They have no way of realizing that something like clear-cutting trees in the rainforest will raise the water level, which will increase the incidence of malaria and really be a major health hazard, could destroy their gardens, and so forth. But when outside concerns come in and say, gee, we'd like to pay you a lot of cash for these trees, people in rainforest regions have no way of knowing what kind of impact this is really going to have on their lives.
My guest is ethnomusicologist Stephen Feld. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Ethnomusicologist Stephen Feld is my guest. What are some of the changes you've seen already in the years that you've been going back to this part of the world?
Well, with the impact of evangelical missionization, which began in the early 1970s, one of the extraordinary impacts has been the end of the ceremonial life of these people. The missionaries found all the costumes, the dramatic and emotional displays of the people, the drumming, their all-night-long song ceremonies, their tradition of spirit mediumship and shamanic performances. They found all of these things terribly suspect and did everything possible to encourage people to destroy or burn all of the artifacts associated with these ceremonies and to cease the performance of the ceremonies.
Well, you actually have a recording of one of the song ceremonies on your new CD. When did you record this? You did it before people stopped performing
right.
it.
Yes, people stopped performing these ceremonies in the mid-1980s, and they have not been revived since. So this was recorded earlier in the 1980s. It's the only track on the CD that was not recorded in 1990.
Before we hear an excerpt of this, tell us something about it. And this is a song that is very sad. I mean, even if you don't know what the lyrics are about, you can hear by the singing
right.
how sad it is.
Well, one of the extraordinary things about these ceremonies that were traditionally performed is that the purpose of the songs was to make members of the audience cry. Guests would compose songs intended to make the hosts think of their deceased relatives or think of their former longhouses or places which had very deep emotional resonances or attachments for them. When they would hear those songs, they would burst out in tears, and then they would become so overcome with the grief of the songs that they would grab resin torches and scar the back of the dancer and singer who had composed that song as a way of acknowledging the power of the song.
Let's hear some of a song from a song ceremony.
Yeah.
Is that sobbing that we're hearing part of the song, or is that one of the listeners' responses to the sadness of the song?
That's a listener's response to the sadness of the song. What you're hearing there are two costume dancers dancing up and down. The rattling sound is crayfish claw rattles in their costumes. And they are singing in this echoed, lift-up, oversounding, overlapping way. And they hardly get into the song at all before a man is just totally overcome with tears of grief and anguish. 20 years ago, his brothers left this area for a labor contract. They were among the first to leave this area, and they never came back. And so the text of that song sings the names of places from the faraway world. He thought of his brothers and was overcome with deep sadness over the loss of those brothers, and that's what moved him to such a profound crying response.
I want to get back to the missionaries. You said that the missionaries were very disturbed by some of the ceremonies they
right.
saw and did their best to convince, with some success, to convince the Kalali to stop performing the ceremonies. And the song ceremony is an example of something that no longer exists. Did they think the scarring part of the ceremony was barbaric?
Yes, they thought that that was brutal. They didn't understand the evocation and the pathos and the dramaturgy of these ceremonies. They also didn't understand why they were important to the people. And the missionaries came to replace Kalali culture with a version of evangelical Christianity, which is of their own devising.
Did you participate in that dialogue at all between the missionaries and the Kalali people?
I've been participating in it in an ongoing way, but it's a very complex dialogue. The missionaries in this area like to say, we're missionaries, we're not theologians. They are not there to discuss the intellectual, artistic merits of Kalali culture with an anthropologist. They're there to change the people and to provide them with alternatives. It also should be said that many of the mission activities are really undertaken by evangelized Papuans who come into these areas and in many cases are much more zealous than the expatriate European missionaries.
You've got to ask yourself, though, I'm sure, if it's your position to try to stand in the way of change, whether that change is the pipeline through the rainforest or missionaries trying to convert the people of the culture. I mean, I think, do you ever ask yourself, do you have a vested interest almost in keeping things the way they are because it's the people who you've studied, you probably don't want to see them change? And I think there's a typical thing that people who study folklore are involved in, too, that they want they want to preserve things the way they are, even when certain people from that culture want to see things change.
Well, I accept change as an inevitable feature of cultural and biological life. Certainly it's been going on in Papua New Guinea for 30,000 years, and the people were always dynamically involved in some kind of change. What I'm really concerned with is survival. I think that it's very clear that there's a relationship between environmental destruction and cultural destruction. We don't question this so much among biologists or zoologists. When they say we're losing 15,000 to 20,000 species of plants and animals a year, when they say we're losing 35,000 acres of rainforest a year, when they talk about endangered species, we don't question them. But why shouldn't we be talking about endangered music? How many songs have been lost this year? How many myths? How many instruments? How much intellectual diversity on the planet is going with this destruction of plant and animal diversity? So I feel that there's a need to see cultural and ecological survival as very connected issues. And this recording is meant to dramatize the extraordinary sound world of the rainforest and this kind of interplay of environmental sound and musical creativity, and through that to ask the question about how the survival of art and the survival of the environment are linked.
Steve, can you choose something that we haven't already played from your CD Voices of the Rainforest and introduce it to us?
How about number five, the bamboo jew's harp? And what's interesting about it is that the man is playing duet with crickets. And he's playing a duet with the birds around him, and this is another idea of lift up over sounding. You take the sounds around you, and you imitate them, and you become part of them by playing a duet with them. And you'll hear that there's a kind of cross rhythm of the pulsing crickets in the environment, and the twanging rhythm of the bamboo jew's harp in the player's mouth.
Steve Fell, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Stephen Feld's CD, Voices of the Rainforest, is on Ryko Disc. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. More reports this evening on relief efforts along the Iraqi borders with Iran and with Turkey from Deborah Wong and John Hockenberry. Michael Scholar tells us from Kuwait about the U.S. troops leaving and the United Nations forces arriving there to take control of the occupied territory in southern Iraq. A story from Utah that in 1957 and 58, the U.S. Army germ warfare people scattered clouds of cadmium sulfide over many states east of the Rockies. It was a test to see if large-scale germ warfare would be feasible. The Army now says the chemical was dangerous, but that wasn't known at that time.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The decade of the 90s is already more than one-tenth over. If you feel like the 90s are passing you by, TV critic David Bianculli has one prescription, a weekly dose of the public TV series The 90s.
I don't even know how to describe this series if you haven't seen The Great American Dream Machine, and I know that most people haven't. Dream Machine was on PBS more than 20 years ago, and it was a variety show in the truest sense. You never really knew what was going to come next, only that it was bound to be interesting. It's the same thing with The 90s, a public TV series that has just begun its third season and has been picked up by more PBS member stations than ever before. It's easy to see why. The 90s is TV as guerrilla theater, as investigative journalism, as video democracy. The 90s is everywhere and is liable to do anything. Take the episode about television, which shows up on most PBS stations this week. It starts with street-level coverage of a New York anti-war demonstration at the end of January and starts out pretty normally. That is, until producer-reporter Skip Bloomberg starts talking to a meek-looking protester named Betty, who turns out to have some TV connections of her own.
Yes, I'm handing out a list of national news media so that as people, as individuals, hear news which they feel is biased on one side or another, they feel emboldened to call up and urge the media to be that important voice which calls the government policies into question.
But is there something about television itself that... This is for the 90s, by the way. It's a PBS show.
Well, I work for Mr. Rogers. I've been Lady Aberlin on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood for 23 years. When people who don't watch Mr. Rogers ask me what he's like, what's he like? I have joked over the years, he's kind of like the flip side of Big Brother.
Pretty neat, huh? Well, next comes a report by Todd Alcott, anchorman, who, well, I'll let him tell you.
Good evening. This is the news. I'm an anchor. You can tell by the outfit. If I were a commentator, I'd be 30 years older. If I were a weatherman, I'd be fat. If I were a sports announcer, I'd have a really bad haircut. If I were a war correspondent, I'd wear a safari costume and stand in front of a photograph of a famous foreign landmark, the Eiffel Tower, or the Taj Mahal, or the pyramids, or just in front of a map. A map lends a flavor of intrigue. Through the miracle of television, we can bring you the news when it happens, as it happens. We will bring you the news quickly and accurately, just as soon as the government says we can. The government will tell us, and then we will tell you. Then the paternalistic commentator, 30 years older than me, will tell you that the government is lying. The government will say one thing, and the commentator will challenge it. And then we will cut to a commercial.
What else is crammed into this TV show about TV shows? Well, my favorite piece is a true, if slightly dated, investigative story called Peter Popoff Revealed. Popoff is a Los Angeles TV faith healer, or was until this report first came out. It shows Popoff in action, dazzling his ministry members by guessing their names and ailments and enthusiastically healing them. But at the same time, it intercepts and includes the secret FM radio transmissions that are being fed into Popoff's earpiece receiver from Popoff's wife, who's sending him the key info from backstage. There's also a wickedly funny essay by Bob Mustang, who talks about TV as pablum and how people will watch anything. Then he turns and walks away, but turns around again about 10 seconds later, points at the camera, and says, "Bet you're still watching, aren't you?" Yeah, I am, when the approach is this varied and the material this good. In this same one-hour show, there's also some blues guitar performances, a visit with the advertising writer who created Joe Isuzu, and a visit with Los Angeles TV critic Howard Rosenberg, who has 4 TV sets. Big deal. I have 6 TV sets. Then again, he has a Pulitzer. Maybe I'm watching too many TVs, or just too much TV, period. But when TV's as good as the 90s, it's a pleasure.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The International Writers' Organization, PAN, is giving a Freedom to Write award to a Moroccan author who's serving a life sentence for his writing. On the next Fresh Air, we speak to the writer's wife and to a representative from PAN. Also, we talk beer with one of the world's leading experts on the subject, Michael Jackson. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
And some of those storms may have very gusty winds clearing later on.